with Doc Ewan on 12th August 1979. So what range was yellow tuned over?
I believe it was about plus or minus 150 kilohertz, and that was done by cavity tuning a 3C22 lighthouse tube, mm-hmm. I recall, in a radar jammer cavity. It was a surplus World War II device. It was a very stable.
And what was your form of output to...
The method of determining the frequency is quite linear with just a manual drive on the cavity for that small range. And the method of measuring frequency was by that very complex, old, in those days, synthesizing harmonics with general radio equipment that was strewn all over most of the laboratory. Mm-hmm. Most of what I had in there, in that laboratory, was frequency measuring equipment. And we would count up and down and check and check.
Right.
And this was then evaluated independently for me.
And your signal output was just a strip chart?
Right, just strip chart. It was an S9 Angus. Crank it up with a crank.
No, I've seen pictures where you're there with headphones on. Was that just testing equipment? Did you actually do any observations that way?
Well, occasionally I would put on the headphones when observing in the evening just to listen to the heterodyne beat as that oscillator was being tuned, and I had an old comfort chair brought in and put in the lab, and I would just close my eyes and snooze a little, and I'd listen to that thing whistle, and if it gurgled or popped, it was almost like babysitting. I'd be able to come to in time. And then I'd also tell the night janitor what times to definitely wake me up. But I could tell that gadget when it was running correctly. It had all sorts of, because of the number of gears and motors and everything, peculiar little noises going
right.
on and whistles.
And,
so that I could walk into the room and I'd just listen and I could tell you whether a receiver was working or something had happened. It was a
okay.
sound machine.
Well, let's go back to your attempts to detect the line now. So at 10 kilohertz,
right, that did not do
did that work.
Right.
Now, what time were we talking about relative to the final detection,
I'd say
which was March?
Probably in the late summer, fall of 49.
Or 50.
50,
yeah.
Right. You know, we didn't really get it together and try it until early 50. So then the next step was to separate the frequencies further. No other changes were made.
Mm-hmm.
And to accomplish that, it then became necessary to introduce two oscillators in the communication receiver. And that was not a large modification. I also, at that time, did, by just simple interchange in the communication receiver, change the bandwidth to 15 kilohertz to improve sensitivity a little,
mm-hmm.
wondering if I was really improving signal to noise. So I didn't know whether I'd gone outside the line for
right.
sure. So it was tried at both 5 and at 15, and
well, but your switching to 10 kilohertz away had told you that you probably
10 kilohertz
would not be.
I didn't even know it was
over.
There. No, I'm still working on the negative thesis. So
no,
as far as I'm concerned, it's not there.
That's what I'm saying. But you by broadening the bandwidth, you could be sure that you didn't have a super narrow line.
That's for sure. That
right.
I'd already
that would
decided,
be the only thing that would hurt you.
Right.
By broadening
the whole
bandwidth.
The whole
yeah.
focus of attention, right, was to separate the frequencies.
Yeah.
And that could be the only thing that would be of any value in searching for the totally negative thesis.
But now, in fact, you just said that we're not worrying about Earth's Doppler motion. So
I wasn't worrying about anything.
If there had been a very
narrow
line, you would have missed it, would
absolutely.
You not?
Absolutely.
Unless it by luck had been right, at the
left. Matter of fact, it was detected by luck. And I'll tell you.
Okay, we're getting there.
Yeah,
okay.
We're getting there. But I then put the two oscillator system together. But it was fixed. I was unable to adjust it. Do it quickly. And the switching then was something like 25 kilohertz. And it was on square wave. A little neater job than this wheel.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing that I could really say was a detection. Some little gurgles and burbles, but they could have been problems that the machine was generating for itself. So then we had a summit meeting, and I recall it was in the fall of 50. And it was, are we ready to go for the negative thesis? And Purcell was just a giant at those meetings. You know, he'd say, rather than, are we going to discuss whether this is the time to go for negative, he was more upbeat on, is there anything else that you'd like to buy or try before mm-hmm. you let it go down the drain? And I said, well, it would be very expensive. And there was just one other thing I'd like to try, and I separate the frequencies further, but to do it, I'd have to buy a new receiver. And it was a new one that National Company had just come out with, and it cost $300. I had that. Then I'd modify that. If that didn't work, nothing would work. But if we don't have that kind of money, because we only have $500 for the program, and we'd spent the $500 on the horn. So he said, well, if that's your decision, come on back tomorrow and we'll finalize it. So I came in the next day, and I mentioned it to him occasionally, and this is one of the things he never has given me an answer as to how this happened. But he said, now, you're sure, $300 and you buy that receiver and then that's going to be it. Yeah, he reached in, pulled out his wallet, and took out $300 and said, go. I don't know where the $300 came from. It was cash.
Laundered.
So, there it was, and I said, yes, sir, I'll do my thing. And I bought the receiver and modified the receiver.
Amazing.
And did that with loving care, working with that receiver. And the very first night I turned it on, put that thing on, the line was detected.
I see.
Very peculiar way.
What was your switching now? How far away?
75. And I knew everything was, it sounded good. The machine was really running beautifully. And I was scanning the plus minus 150. And that, I started scanning through the rest frequency. And that line was just stable. All the way to the end, and I thought, well, you know, just let it run, because maybe Columbia goofed. And at the very end, and that's probably the record I should have kept, at the very end of that strip chart record, and this is about 6 feet long, and rest of my angles, you see this thing going along, at the end, it went up, off scale, up.
Right.
And I said, my God, what could that be? That is too resonant for anything I've got in this machine. So I knew, though, my feeling was 100% that it was an equipment error that I was unfamiliar with, some sort of resonance.
So this is 75 kilohertz off the rest frequency.
No, I'm 75 kilohertz switching. I'm 150.
Oh, you're 150 off. Okay.
I'm at the end of my scan.
Right.
I couldn't go any further. The oscillator wouldn't scan any further. The motor, you know, boom, it's the limit and that's it.
Yeah.
And this thing had just come, so I just moved everything back 150 kilohertz, and the thing goes.
But you had enough confidence in your receiver, though.
Oh, yeah.
Not to just dismiss that.
Well, I didn't think it was the line, but I knew.
But you had to investigate it anyway.
And I could quickly investigate it by just shifting over here and scan that part.
Mm-hmm.
But had I stopped at, say, 100 kilohertz instead of 150, I never would have seen that.
You would have had your negative thesis.
All set. And the minute I saw that, what the devil could be 150 kilohertz? And that's when I started thinking and sketching this thing up.
Yeah.
Well, and that's when I called the Harvard Observatory. And I said, and this was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I said, this physics department at Harvard, we're performing an experiment here.
Oh, you got someone at 2 a.m.?
Yeah, I got a 2 a.m. Some grad student came on the phone, you know. And I said, we're over here in the physics department, we're performing an experiment that involves astronomical coordinates. And I can tell you that we're now looking almost directly south of the declination of minus 5. But what I'd like to know is, can you tell me the component of the velocity vector in that direction as a function of hour angle, say around, say, from midnight till 3 in the morning?
Right.
And because I'm trying to measure a Doppler shift. A big pause. Who are you? The physics department, Harvard. What are you looking at? Interstellar gas. We're looking at a resonance. An interstellar gas, I need a Doppler component from you fellas. Well, you better call us some other time. Doppler? What are you guys doing over there? Is this a prank call? You know, that was one of those. I thought, okay, I'll get in touch with you later. But this zip, and I didn't even bother. After that, I didn't call the observatory. I just got the books and looked it up. And well, computed it myself.
There had been work done on that sort of thing.
Right. Sure, it isn't that complicated. But at 2 in the morning, you figure, heck, I'm sitting right here at Cambridge. Why can't I call the Harvard Observatory and have a fellow just spew that to me over the phone? Why should I go to all the details of looking it up?
In fact, did you worry at all about...
I hadn't worried about anything.
No, but about where you were looking in the sky, or did you just tune on when you got things working?
The only thing I was concerned about was to pay attention when the Milky Way went by.
Okay, so you did do that.
Right, that's the only thing I worried about. I knew I was looking south. I knew when the Milky Way would go by, and the line came in just about ballpark.
But you didn't care if it was daytime or nighttime, for instance.
No, not at all. The only thing that made nighttime attractive was that's when I wasn't working at the nuclear lab. So in the daytime, the machine ran by itself. So I had it set up that at noon, I would go over, crank it on, because it'd be just 12 hours later, and the Milky Way was going by around 2 o'clock. So I was just catching it on the other side, and I just crank around and let her do her scan, and it would automatically stop at the end of the scan. I'd go over at night and take a look at it. And I remember, after I got this detection, I was picking up that one on the backside of the galaxy. See, the thought was, the whole astronomical input at that time, was if you're going to see anything, you're going to see it in Sagittarius. But you need a big, dense cloud, and that follows right in the middle of the galaxy. And this idea of looking around and casually seeing hydrogen all over the place hadn't occurred to anyone. Mm-hmm. And when I saw it in the anti-center, that thing came in really strong and narrow, and I just dismissed that. Now, I was too busy getting it over here where it belonged at night when I was there. If it wanted to do it in the afternoon on its own time, I would just take those and pile them up and forget that.
This is now a few months later?
No, this is at the same time. The line was being detected in Ophiuchus. It was picking it up in the afternoon for me automatically. But I wouldn't believe it, because I figured, okay, that was the day I said, MIT's on the air, somebody's goofing me up the car line.
So there's no mention of that in your thesis at all?
No, I never mentioned it to Purcell until much later. That I had the Edison, it was showing up over there, and it was even neater and clearer, but I wouldn't believe it if I wasn't there.
Okay, well, this brings up a related question, is how was the angle of the horn chosen? In other words, declination minus 5.
It was chosen on the basis of the waveguide bend that is commercially available at L-band that will allow you to bring your waveguide horizontally out a window and then up. And that comes out minus 5.
Did you pick a room that was facing the south purposely?
Yes, I did.
You did do that?
I did do that. Okay. Definitely want to look south. I wanted to be on the local meridian, and I did check out the road that we were within 10 degrees or something.
Okay.
But that reminds me of one that Friis told me, because I asked him at one time, why were all the antennas that Kennedy was building and were being used in troposcatter, why were all those 28 feet? And why weren't they 30 or something?
Yeah.
Or some number of meters? And he said, it turns out that plywood is 14 feet long, and he built the first one as a model in wood, and then Fallis came along with their aluminum, 28 feet.
Well, that's how Grote Reber's dish, his was a 30-foot dish for the same reason, the length of wood they could get at the local lumber store.
And that's what Friis was doing at Bell.
Maybe actually it's the same. Maybe the same lumber standards that made that 28 feet the same as Reber's 30-foot
dish. Somebody put a vertex in the middle for a Reber.
Amazing. Okay, so, I wanted to ask, the frequency switching, where did the idea come for that?
The idea was at that initial meeting with Purcell, and I think it was just a natural nuclear resonance, and Purcell said just frequency switch.
Was it a standard technique at that time? NMR?
Right. All the other grad students at that time were doing nuclear resonance type work, and that was a fairly standard.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, trying to decide what we would call the thesis, and what discipline was the thesis. My final doctorate sheepskin says microwave spectroscopy. So it's, tried to decide which hill we're going to be on. We're going to be in microwave spectroscopy. And that is the standard technique.
Right.
But it was Purcell who suggested it, and I think it was unfortunate that it didn't get greater recognition, particularly that idea wasn't recognized as a rather significant thought, because Dickey's contribution was really switch load.
Mm-hmm.
And switch frequency is not really a true Dickey. And that, so that was a whole new radiometer type, much the same as a line rep machine whatever. But it has always been called the Dickey radiometer.
But he was the one that developed it for frequency switching for NMR. You're saying Purcell developed it for
NMR. Purcell, yeah. I would say, is, well, without question, he was the one that suggested it for this application.
Well, and for NMR also, though. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? I didn't.
I believe so.
you were working all the time at the on the accelerator.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was really, like you said, a hobby
nights.
Almost.
This was nights and weekends. Right. I was putting in my 40 hours nuclear.
And for Purcell also, you said that he was away a lot of the time. And
well, he was really tied into those committee meetings, getting with the Korean War, and he was fairly high up with the Defense Department. So most of the fellows were shuttle hopping to Washington, most of the key scientific groups in those days. And I think he was essentially assigned almost on a sabbatical for about a year, assigned up to Washington.
See.
But at the times I needed him, he was there. He participated in all the major decisions. And certainly while we're hacking wood and putting things together, in many ways I benefited possibly by the fact that he wasn't there, that I could get some things done at the nuclear lab and I wouldn't have to say, well, I haven't done anything for 2 weeks then. But I knew what schedules were and I could just get the thing ultimately put together. And He was a very very good advisor in the sense that he never really bugged me. He just wouldn't even call.
Yeah.
And I would wonder
whether he cared or not.
I would look at the phone and say, boy, if he calls, what am I going to say?
Okay, so having this initial detection, which looked pretty good, you said that you now thought about the whole business of Doppler. And within a few days?
Almost immediately. Right. As a matter of fact, when I first discussed it with Ed, I recall the night it was first detected was the 25th of March. And within 2 or 3 days, right around there, I had it really nailed down and understood why the frequency shift. Mm-hmm. And then I just picked a morning when I was confident that was it, and that everything appeared reasonable. That I can recall taking the Esterline Angus roll about 30 feet, and I knew where Ed would be coming in the morning. Usually, came down a long haul in the Croft, and I had my old red shot, bloodshot eyes, and a red eye on. And I took the roll and I zipped it about 30 feet right at his feet. And I said, there it is. And he stopped me. Really? Yeah. There it is.
Oh, great.
Yeah. It was just beautiful.
Yeah.
So then from there on in, it was, well, come on to the office and we'll find out what you detected.
But now, still was there not some luck involved? Because you calculated the orbit of the Earth and got that motion. And so
I got Hercules too. I knew the Sun, the solar system going on.
You got that.
Got that.
But now, of course, there's the whole galaxy.
Yeah, I didn't get that.
And if the line had been at minus 100 with respect to local standard of rest or something, you still would have been way off.
Right. No, I was strictly playing hydrogen at rest.
Yeah.
And the solar system moving.
Right.
But the only one moving in the whole shell.
Right. So now, What do you do at this stage then? How do you follow this up further?
At this point, it was treated as that was an experiment to be performed in physics. It has been performed. It's complete, and had been performed by the astronomy department. It would have been a different thing. But in the physics department, it was strictly an experiment in microwave spectroscopy, and a very convenient laboratory. It worked, and there was obviously some significance that would be drawn by astronomers.
Mm-hmm.
So it was in that context that we sort of wrap it all up, and let's put it away, but maybe we're jumping, well, it was right about that time that Purcell then said, for the publication of this field of radio astronomy, who are the people, because I'd done that literature search, who are the people and who do we get in touch with? And then he sent a wire to Pawsey, Australia, and went off to well, was going to be the Netherlands. I don't know how the details of how he discovered that Vanderhulst was at the observatory. He may have met him, I don't know. It was not my opinion that he had. I have no recollection of any thought that he had met him. Certainly never discussed it with me, other than telling me, isn't it coincidental that Vanderhulst is there? And now that we have gone through the 2 months of assuring ourselves that we have detected lying, he said, why don't you go and see Vanderhulst? And it was very much like Purcell, who, though a very important cog in the whole wheel, it was typically a Purcell to say, hey kid, you did it, you tell it.
Mm-hmm.
And which, to me, I looked at it that way, you know, and my eyes glowed a little and said,
right,
that's my father saying that.
Yeah,
you know, he
right.
said, hey kid, go ahead, right. be a big guy, go tell him. So I, hat in hand, went up there to the observatory looking for Hank Vanderhulst, located him, and just very quietly told him my name and what I'd done with at Purcell. And it was, he was quite shocked, to say the least.
He had known nothing about this operation at all?
No, I had never talked to him before. He was quite taken back about all of this having happened. And so then he asked me the details of where we were looking and how it was done, and I had brought along some strip chart, but I hadn't brought schematic drawings and those details.
Yeah.
But he then did place a call immediately to Ort, and he got Ort and Mueller on the phone. And
while you were still in the office?
Oh, yes, right, immediately. And asked me to, he then described to them where the detection had occurred and what the intensity was. And then they asked that I come on the phone and describe how it was done, how switch frequency operated, what noise figure had been measured, what was the signal to noise ratio, and how the thing was calibrated, mm-hmm. and the use of this noise source, things like that, that apparently were new to the Dutch. And so I went through quite a discussion in some detail, and agreed then I would send schematic drawings and any of the parts, like 6AK5 low noise preamp tubes, that weren't available conveniently to the Dutch, to get all of these to Vanderhulst so that he could expedite their shipment to mm-hmm. to Holland. And then the understanding was really we'd appreciate a confirmation, since they had paused the detection.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not then meet again with Vanderhulst until the time of my doctorate oral.
Hmm.
And he was on the committee with Purcell, yeah. of course. And,
and when was that?
That was probably a couple of months later. And the interim was occupied by the fact that I'd completed then the thesis, and I wrote it up. I'd get out the 47 pages and then take the oral. But I had one other thing that I had not completed, and that was my German qualification. So I packed that bag and went to Vassar, where I knew a friend that spoke German. And I spent, right after the detection, right after talking to Vanderhulst, I spent 2 or 3 weeks out at Vassar studying German. And that got to be pretty well known by Bach, who was in South Africa at the time. He said Ort was furious. How could anyone detect an interstellar line and then be studying German? Because, and that's what I was doing, because otherwise I wouldn't get my PhD.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I remember getting the German out of the way was the professor in charge of the German exam was Oldenburg, atomic physics.
Mm-hmm.
And Oldenburg selected a chapter out of Abraham and Becker, mm-hmm. electromagnetic theory. And he told me about the chapter. He said, here's the book, and it's in German. He said, I'm sure you're familiar with the text. And I'm going to just translate this chapter. And he left me in a room all by myself. And to the door came Philippe Franck. And if you know Philippe Franck, who succeeded as the chair of Einstein, he's quite a speaker, a mother of a grad student or possibly an undergrad student, it trapped Frank right there at the door of the room where I was trying to get my German out of the way after 3 weeks at Vassar. And Frank was screaming, his hands going up and down, and telling about this poor kid was going to have to be kicked out of school for a while. And so I just picked up everything, and I went upstairs to another room. And then Oldenburg found me up there. My God, he said, thank heavens I found you. He said, you know what you've done? You violated this and that, and you should notify the dean. I said, so I told him about Frank, and I said, you're going to ask him. I said, he was blowing my mind down there. I just went to another empty classroom. And that's all that happened. And so then he quickly looked at what I'd written, and he said, gee, that's a beautiful job of the chapter. He said, but it's not the edition you're reading. But he said, I think you know German anyway. You know a few words. And that was it. So that's that aside. Then, as I said, I didn't meet Vanderhulst again until we got down to oral time.
Now, let me just check on dates here, because the Dutch detection was in late April, around April 20th.
Mm-hmm.
And so you must have spent only a week or two, really, in your confirmatory observations before you went and told Vanderhulst.
We told Vanderhulst. I guess we... I may have... well, my feeling was... I see what you mean. My feeling at the time, I had wrapped it up in 3 days, was that I had it. The great concern was Purcell's, that I had the MTA or a harmonic.
That's right, you haven't said that for the record.
Right.
You're worried about some interference possibilities.
When I showed Ed the chart and I said, there it is, he said, come to the office, we'll see what you detected. And I was a little concerned when he got on the phone and called tech and wanted to know what they were doing. And he was interested that there was something on the paper, but he was then going to search out what it was. And I was quite confident because everything checked, but it had only been 2 or 3 days that I'd worked it.
Right.
And it may have been at that time that, and I was certainly the motivation for confirmation was with Ed, to not only how do you join the Radio Astronomy Club, but how do you appropriately make certain that this has been detected, because though you can try a lot of things individually, he did recognize the significance of the measurement as an interesting experiment in physics.
Really wanted a completely independent...
Right, and so he may have been motivated very very early on then to say, go find Vanderhulst. Because I know even at those early meetings, he was discussing who should we get in touch with, and settled on the Dutch and the Australians, and though the English were quite active at the time, we did not contact them.
Now, do you remember any advice from Vanderhulst about how you might, from an astrophysical point of view, how you might improve your techniques or follow it up, or specifically whether you might go to yet further frequency switching?
No. There was no discussion. The only discussions I had with Vanderhulst were the original one, after the line was detected, and then at the time of the doctorate oral, when after I was asked a couple of relatively simple questions in physics, the meeting broke up with Purcell and Vanderhulst at the blackboard for about 2 hours discussing what this all meant from the physics and astronomy standpoint. Mm-hmm. And I can recall sitting there dozing and listening to these giants with my feet up on the chair until at some point Purcell looked around and said, oh, you're all set, Doc. You can run along.
you thought this was still part of your exam.
Right. I was waiting for them to then turn around and say, now that you've listened to us, what do you think? But fortunately, he said I could leave.
Right.
And on that basis, so that was the only other time. And the next time, I guess, I met Vanderhulst was at Leiden. And took a trip over there sometime later.
It's always interesting to me, the two papers in Nature that came out are so different in their approach. Your paper with Purcell is physics of
physics,
the line, and their paper is entirely galactic structure.
Right.
An entirely different approach. Yeah.
And the telegram for Australia, detection.
Right, we got it. Yep. We slapped together the receiver,
right.
We got it.
Works.
Okay, so you got your degree then, right? Only 3 months after after the lie detection, mm-hmm. And then was there no more follow up in the physics department?
None. As a matter of fact,
said that the experiment is done. And
experiment's done. We notified the Harvard Observatory, of course, because I'd been there with Van der Hulst, and Harlow Shapley was the director at the time. And there was no real interest to pursue it
Menzel,
further.
No
interest at all at Harvard. And so we just packed up shop. There were some visiting firemen that would drop by and occasionally. And I'd be over at the nuclear lab, and Ed would call and say so-and-so's coming into town and he wants to see the machine. Mm-hmm. And so we converged there for a couple of hours, turn it on, and make it do its little Rube Goldberg, Quick Spock, and its little audio things. And if he happened to be there when the galaxy was around, he'd get a line that he could take home. And so that was about it. It was a little pony show. And I was then, at that time, very involved with this Korean War thing and being called back to active duty and problems with whether I was going to be in the Navy and finish up. And there was a lot of confusion in that area. So that as far as operating the equipment any further, no.
But basically, you were working at the on the accelerator,
right?
During those years,
right? Getting the line out, and I got getting the proton beam out of the cyclotron, and that occurred just 3 weeks prior to the detection of the line.
Oh, I see.
So it was just bang bang, and everything was over, and we'll just wrap up and decide what comes next, and try not to have another war.
And you were in a race, apparently. On
getting it right, that was with Fermi at Chicago, which I felt was the great accomplishment. If I were asked at that time, what is the greatest thing you did in 51? And certainly for the next 2 or 3 years, I would have answered the external beam from the Harvard cyclotron. FMing the cyclotron, get the external beam, and beat the boys in Chicago. Hmm. And that was it. That's where I spent all my time.
It would be an interest. Let me ask you. At what stage did you feel like the importance of the 21-centimeter line was greater?
Well, that was... it started about a year later when Bart Bok came back from South Africa. And that was also the beginning of Ewan Knight. It started with Bok. And when he came back, he looked me up within hours after he got back into town. And at that time, I was working on an underwater warfare problem, which was more important than my being in Korea. And I was working for a company called Scientific Specialties, which was an outgrowth of the nuclear lab. And Bart looked me up and asked what the status of the machine was. I believe, prior to his return, this is the part that Ed and I haven't quite resolved how it happened. But that machine filled a room about the size of this room. Just jammed. And in that period, about that early summer, during the summer.
Of 52?
Of 51.
Oh, 51.
Right. Still the machine.
The Bok came back when, though?
Bok came back, I believe. Early 52 or something like that, somewhere in there, about a year. It's probably spring of 52. Well, I was in there in between those two times. When I was working during the summer, I remember a call to go to Washington to talk to Vannevar Bush. And we walked the park in Washington, and he told me of the great virtues of being a fellow at Carnegie, and that they had decided that I should come to Carnegie and be a fellow, and I would have to worry about anything the rest of my life. Which immediately convinced me I didn't want to go to Carnegie. He said the wrong thing.
Right.
So, Merrill Tube, I guess, sort of put him up to it, the head of the Department of Terrestrial Magnetism. Mm-hmm. But Van Bush and the boys at MIT, I think the president of MIT went to Caltech. Who was he? I got to know him.
At that time?
Right. He was a buddy of Conant's, and I believe he became president of Caltech.
No, DuBridge?
DuBridge, right. DuBridge and Van Bush were buddies. And of course, DeBridge was
he had been head of the Rad Lab.
Purcell, and I mean, it was a real tight club.
Right, sure.
And so between DeBridge and Van Bush and all that, so I don't know what part Purcell played in all of this, because in those months he was back to Washington, and I didn't really get to see that much of him other than occasional call as a fireman coming down. But I remember describing this whole thing then to how to operate the machine to Merrill Tooth.
Mm-hmm.
And it was my understanding that an arrangement had been made to ship all of it to Washington. And I was on my way off to back to my submarines. And so a truck arrived one day, and we put everything in the truck, and it went to Washington. They didn't want the horn. That went to Smithsonian and then went down to Greenbank. And so Merrill Tooth and Carnegie had the original machine.
Right.
And it wasn't until it was much later, I think it was in the late fall of 51, about in there, that I had a call from Carnegie. But they put it all together, dusted it all off, and it didn't work.
Of course.
This is what I call a confirmation. So I buzzed down to Washington and fiddled with the machine, and they put it all together. There wasn't much fiddling. And we just, they had a big 60-foot antenna, I believe, right there in the downtown Washington, and pointed it off toward a local cloud, and in it came. And Tooth made an interesting comment at the time. He said, you know, when you set it down, a part of it I'd build out of 2x4s because we couldn't afford relay racks, and I had wooden things were sitting on little shelves there. So they had all these little wooden things. And I had a place that I hang my jacket, a little hat hook and a 2x4. And he said, you know, Doc, we saw all that. We put it all back together. We put your hat hook up. He said, we didn't realize the thing doesn't work unless your hat's hanging out. I said, that's it. Took my hat off. She works. So one of those guys. And then with Bach, when he came back, he looked me up, and he apparently raised the roof with the Harvard Observatory with Menzel and Shapley, and how ridiculous it was that they
letting this all slip away.
Oh yeah, I said, just absolutely ridiculous. Not only letting the equipment go, but letting this team fall apart. And so he, if you know Bart, you know, he really gets in there.
And I've talked to him for this project also.
And he did it all. He, at that point, just said, end of nonsense. Pull the team together. Got hold of Purcell, myself, and Shapley, and Menzel. And we all went over to the Harvard faculty club, and had our horse steak or whatever, popular over there. At a little summit meeting, decide what Harvard was going to do about this. To pacify Bach, because Bach was going to say we're going to do something about it. Well, very quickly became apparent that Bach had convinced Shapley, and Shapley was ready to go, was all tuned, and that Harvard was going to move into the field of 21-centimeter research. It would be a major effort. We'd immediately go for NSF funding and put Harvard on the map. This was the chance that all radio astronomy in the U.S. had been waiting for to get something going here rather than have it running in England and Australia and so forth. This would be the focus. So everybody nod. Of course, with Bach, you just nod your head. So we nodded, and it's general. And then Shapley said, well, now we've got to figure out how to do it. And so he turned to Purcell, how are we going to do it? Can Doc build a machine for the observatory? And I said, sure, that's the only problem is I'm working. You know, and I've got this thing with scientific specialty. So how about getting the engineering department to do it? And Purcell said, engineering department? Did you have anyone in mind? Harvard or MIT? And I said, well, we're talking about a Harvard program here. So we don't have an engineering department. So that's out of the question. How about MIT? Well, not really in it. Well, it's Harvard. Because though Harvard and MIT are very close, they're not all that close when it comes to something like this.
Yeah.
But, so I'm picking up these little niceties at the table. So then finally, Purcell said, and this was strictly a Purcellism. He said, well, I'll tell you what we'll do. He said, Doc, you know how to build it. We can't build it in the university. why don't you form a company, build it, and then liquidate the company, and that way we'll have the machine. And he said, now, all I got to do is figure out how much it's going to cost, and Harlow, you just pay Doc his corporation, so it'll be Harvard University, some corporation, right, to build it. And this is Purcell, my business school manager. And Shapley said, well, it sounds great to me, casually, you know, and box it as long as we can get the job done. So everybody, here I was sitting with these fellows, and they all started looking at my end of the table and saying, well, what's the name of the company? When are you going to have it ready? And how much is it going to cost? And I said, what? Purcell throws an idea on the table, and suddenly everybody's jumping me for answers. So I said, well, I'll be back and get in touch with you, see whether we can do something. So I got in touch with my buddy, Bill Pritchett, and we spent an evening going over Bill's Raytheon, what it would take. And like, maybe could Raytheon build it, let me go back to my submarines. And what we came up with probably cost around $100,000. In most days.
Right.
And no way were we going to get that type of money for hardware into a company out of NSF. We could get a couple hundred grad students on it, but not that. So we fiddled and fiddled with it, and just finally just the bare pieces would, for the receiver, were going to cost somewhere around $10,000 or $15,000. And Raytheon wouldn't touch it. And the Pritchett told me they wouldn't let it in the door. So then the problem was, okay, it looks like I've got to form the company. And I had just about wrapped up my project, and the Korean situation had cooled enough, so I thought I could afford to go into astronomy without making it look like I wasn't needed at Sandia or something to do cube clearance, because that's all I wanted me for, was live out my life at Sandia making bombs. So then decision was made, and I got back with Shapley to proceed, form a company. So at that time, you know, he was out of it. I had to then work with the astronomy department. And that it would cost $15,000, take about 6 to 9 months. I'd form a company. I'd need $1,000 to capitalize the company. So I borrowed that from a fellow by the name of Knight, who was an MIT graduate. And he was also an Amherst graduate, an old buddy of mine. And Jeff Knight, who did a thesis on quadrupole moments tech, put up $1,000. So he didn't waste time figuring out what we'd call it. We'd call it Ewan Knight. He'd go back and do his thing because he wasn't in radio astronomy. He was in having a lot more money available instantly than I did. So, and 2 years later, I paid him back his $1,000, but retained his name as Ewan Knight, which is spelled with a K.
Right.
And that's why we spelled Day, D-A-E, because we didn't spell Knight right. But it was Harlow Shapley's best statement. He said, when you meet Doc Ewan, you'll find out he's keeping everybody in the night about day, or everybody in in the dark about night. Yeah, he's keeping everybody in the dark about night. That's Harlow. And so we formed a company and located it at 698 Mass Ave, which is right at Central Square, in a furniture store, second floor, short-term lease, build it, get out.
That was going to be it.
That was going to be it. Didn't hire any full-time people, just moonlight Harvard and MIT fellows, Knights, the technicians, the best they had. Mostly pulling fellows out of the lab down on Vassar Street. Instrumentation lab. Right, that's where I got most of the shot stuff. So we'd go to work at 6 o'clock at night. We'd work till 3 in the morning. And then I'd go back to work, sort of red-eyed, and which is kind of the way we do it now with the troops.
But let me ask, though. I mean, undoubtedly you could have had a position at the observatory yourself if you'd wanted. I mean, obviously you chose to go this route.
No, I did. I was one of Bach's, if I haven't mentioned that, at that meeting. Bach insisted that not only we do this thing implementation-wise, engineering-wise, as Purcell suggested, But that additionally, I would join the staff and teach the engineering. Mm-hmm.